Welcome, everyone, to this final Sunday in February, the 28th. Right. And this is going to be our final February meeting. Now, before we start, I wanted to ask you a brief question. Next Sunday, exactly at this time slot, there's an interview with a Buddhist teacher who I respect very, very much. It's a live interview based on his book about Vipassana and scientific overview. And I would highly recommend that if you're interested, that perhaps rather than have it at this time slot, we could sign into the Zoom meeting that he's going to have. And I'll send you all the link. Would you be interested in doing that?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it would be very interesting because you'll get a little bit of a different perspective. We can discuss that afterwards. If you want, we can find an alternative time for our meeting, sometime to after that, perhaps to discuss it.
What's his name?
His name is Paul Fleischman, Dr. Paul Fleischman. He's a psychiatrist. Many interesting things occurred this week, which I'd like to share and start with for thinking. And we're getting to the end of the sutta, so I think I'm going to try to keep the introductory period very short so we can finish the sutra today, because it ends with a great climax that I think we should all pay great attention to. Before we start, what I would like to do is review a few things that we've talked about. First of all, terminology. Buddha means the awakened one, not a god, not a superman, but an awakened being who has realized full knowledge of reality, how it works, how it functions, and ended the production of karma from his being, which means the minute full awakening takes place, his actions in the corporeal body or the physical body no longer produce karma. So that when he dies, that's it, Nibbana. Okay, so there's two concepts of Nibbana. There's Nibbana and there's Parinibbana. Nibbana means extinguishing of karma, and that's given as the definition when he is alive as a being, but he's now stopped producing karma. That's already a tremendously awakened state. Parinibbana means it's gone beyond the extinguishing of karma. When the body dies, there is no remnant whatsoever at all. There's complete dispersal, assimilation, integration, however you would like to terminate it, in reality. Okay, which is a subject of a discussion that could be very interesting for us if we'd like to have that discussion. So, one can approach the Buddha Dharma from many different perspectives. It can be a religion, as you see in Buddhism's. It can be a philosophy, as you see now in this trend towards what they call secular Buddhism. It can also be a science of living. It can be a science of living or an art of living. And the art of living is what the Goenk organization, Paul Fleischman, who I mentioned to you his lecture, they call it the art of living. But it's up to each person, and influenced by their karma and their thinking, as to how they're going to approach the teachings. For myself, as I've tried to communicate to you, I've always looked to something that is trusted, that's been around, but also that resonates with my own personal experience in the practice. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that when I do the practice, as I'm instructed to do it in a way that I understand the instructions, the results that come from the practice mirror and reflect the teachings that introduce me to the practice. Is that clear, the way I express that? So that I develop faith in the practice because the results mirror what the instruction says is going to happen. Now, it is not so precise as, when you breathe in this way, after so many minutes, you're going to see angels, and bingo, I see angels. What it's more about saying, when you breathe in this way, you will start to have absorption. We talked about jhanas, and sure enough, absorption happens. And the absorptions manifest in a certain way. And sure enough, they manifest in a certain way. And certain greater insight and greater vision and greater understanding occurs. And so the practice encourages the faith in the practice, which encourages more practice. But this is a resonance that has to occur in your being. It can't occur anywhere else. You do not do it just on faith, belief. You don't do it because somebody told you. And that, if we return to the sutra we did last week, the section of the sutra, remember where it said personal knowledge. You don't go to other teachers. You don't go to recluses. You don't do ceremonies and observation and rituals. You know it here and now. That's what that section meant. Do you all recall, remember that from last week? That's what that section meant. In your own being, in your own body, in your own mind, you know what you have experienced. That is what it's talking about. So what does it mean when the Buddha is talking about, or in the Buddha Dharma, we talk about dukkha? Okay, what does it really mean? Why is this emphasis on dukkha? That there is some underlying angst beneath everything that we do. Well, life, of course, presents us with wonderful situations, pleasant ones, ecstatic ones, blissful ones, as well as painful ones and cruel ones. And many people will respond when we have a discussion of this nature, well, that's just part of living. We need to move on and move through these experiences. But that's not what the Buddha is talking about when he refers to dukkha. What he is referring to is an underlying angst that becomes a foundation for how we interact with everything around us. So to briefly recap and simplify, the Buddha is raised in this fantastically wealthy, posh, everything environment. He sees for the first time old age, sickness, and death. He sees that nobody escapes this. And on the way to that, there is all this suffering that can occur. He sees that the beautiful things people cling to, the horrible things people have aversion to. And he sees and feels that nothing in his environment can solve this problem, that he's always afraid of losing what he has or not getting or getting something that he doesn't want. And eventually it goes on to old age, sickness, and death. So he looks for a solution to this issue. He cuts his hair, he leaves the temple, he starts practicing all the ascetic practices, masters them all, as we've gone through some of the suttas, almost dies starving himself with one of those practices until he eventually goes to the Bodhi tree, what's now called the Bodhi tree, or it's called the Sala tree before that. And he takes the decision, you recall, I emphasize resolve as the first step, to sit at that tree and not to move until he either gets it or he dies trying. And in that process, he starts to see the connection of how these things all come together. And he comes up with the paticca-samuppada. Actually, let's go. He comes up with the three characteristics. He notices impermanence. He notices that everybody thinks there's this permanent self. So they're clinging things or averting things, and that's not possible. So that leads to this suffering, this existential angst. The avoidance or the desire for things in a kind of semi-permanent way. And the striving for things in the material world and in the emotional world that will give us these comforts or will keep away these discomforts. And so this constant tug of war, that's the dukkha that he's talking about. And then he defines it in the Four Noble Truths as there is dukkha, there is the origin, which is clinging or tanha or adhesion. There's the solution to it, which is getting rid of the clinging and becoming unadhesive or breaking the adhesion. And then he talks about the methodology, a full path. Then he presents the psychological and logical description of what's happening. That's what paticca-samuppada is, dependent origination. He's describing how the process takes place. So he's describing, I see something of pleasure, my eye sees something of pleasure. The object is there, my eye is a physical part, a faculty, and then my brain has this the skill or the ability to perceive that and to translate that. And the minute that's translated into something, it becomes what we call eye consciousness. We've done this in all the suttas already. Same thing happens with the nose and smell and the ear and sound and the mouth and taste and touch with the body and the mind in the sixth sense of consciousness. So he describes how we become attached to things or how we want to avert things by noting it, contact, and the faculties required. And then suddenly that gives rise to perception, to feeling, to consciousness, to formation, to ideas, materiality in our head, and then further into all kinds of a world, I guess that I would describe it, a whole structure in our brain, a three-dimensional hologram that we're thinking that relates to what we're experiencing. And boom, dukkha takes place. We get into that cycle of dependent origination, and we don't realize that these things are only temporal, they're temporary, therefore we attach to them or we push them away, and we start the whole cycle based on ignorance. That energy then propels us through life, and when we die, but the energy is propelled into the next karmic manifestation. And that's birth and then suffering, et cetera, as we saw in the sutta. So this underlying level of angst is almost always present. When we talk with other people, when we reflect among ourselves, when we relate to our own inner nature and our outer nature, how to deal with people that we love, how to deal with people that we work with, how to deal with the environment, how to deal with people that we don't like. Therefore, we can never be truly honest with ourselves or with others or with those around us if there is this underlying suffering, and which is constantly influencing everything as a filter. Does that make sense? That aversion and clinging is always there at a subconscious level. That's the dukkha that the Buddha is talking about. Not the fact that I just fell down and broke my leg. The Buddha is not saying life doesn't have pain or pleasure, but he's saying beyond pain or pleasure, there's an underlying approach or attitude or feeling or emotion or state of mind that is constantly worried about something, either not getting what we want or getting what we don't want or desiring something we don't have. And that necessarily will influence everything that we do in our lives, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed and through the dream state when we're asleep. Okay? So dependent origination thoroughly delineates the contact, perception, feeling, consciousness, formation, mentality, materiality on a chain link structure. Therefore, when we use tools such as certain outside tools, we have to ask, do these tools really allow us to break that chain? Everybody's following me so far? Quinn, following me? Okay. Now, I sent you a couple of links this week. Did you have a chance to look at them and listen to them? Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
These were These were Japanese monks who have started to use techno or beatboxing or other things. Nothing new, visual images to chant sutras, to do various things. Now, this is not new. Chanting and music and various additional methodologies have been part of spiritual practices for thousands of years. In fact, doing hallucinogenic drugs is part of shamanism as far as old as shamanism goes. And I'm sure that's even older, 5 to 10,000 years. But how does that fit now when we're referring in the Buddha Dharma to the cycle of dependent origination? Will that allow us to break the chain? Will that help us to break the chain? Let's put it that way, not allow us. Will that help us to break the chain? What do you think? Based on what we've done so far with dependent origination and this sutra, would anything like that assist us in being able to break the chain of dependent origination? At first impression, we'll say. Why do you say that, Johnny?
Well, it helps you because it helps you accept it, basically.
How does it help you accept it?
Because you see how the mechanism is just formidable. It can't change. It's about your mind being able to understand it and absorb it.
Okay, but how does, if we understand that the goal is to end the suffering or the dukkha, and The dukkha is a result of the process of the dependent origination of arising and cessation. How would that assist us in breaking any of the links along that chain? Something like that.
Right.
What do we need? What do we need in order to be able to hear that sound? The ones that I sent you.
Ears.
Ears.
Sorry?
Okay. What else do we need?
A computer. Access to something, you know, to listen via.
Okay, let's keep it internal within ourselves, assuming it's a live performance. You have your ears. Is all we need is the ear?
Consciousness. Your brain, I mean, perceiving what you're...
We need the faculty, right? That will translate because sound is sound waves, right? In the air. So we need the cilia in our ear. There's a little hairs in our ear that react in our eardrum that will vibrate, that will give the signal to the nerve that will go to the brain, correct?
Right.
Okay, so you need the object, which is the sound. Then you need the faculty, which is what's in the brain.
The brain.
And you also need the actual ear faculty, which is the tool. But is
and
it
the
enough?
Heart.
And the heart. What about what puts the tools together?
The mind.
You need something in the mind. And that's called the object contact. Remember, we talk about contact. The sound comes, we have contact. We then perceive the contact. That's the faculty. Then we have a feeling about the contact. We like it or we don't like it. And then we have consciousness, what's called ear consciousness. Then ear consciousness leads to form. Now we have a form sound, right? And then after the form sound, we get to materiality. We then have a structure, the hologram in our brain. Is everybody following me?
Yeah.
So this is the cycle of dependent origination. So if what we're listening to makes us engage this cycle, how does that help us break this cycle? Good question, huh? My answer, Padmapani's answer only.
Right. You become conscious of the cycle.
Oh, that one.
That's already a good step forward.
No, you don't necessarily become conscious of the cycle unless you practice something. For most people, they're not conscious of the cycle. For most people that listen to these kind of music, or for Johnny, look at these wonderful images as art, they see and think that these images are going to help them raise to a higher plane of understanding. When in fact, what we understand specifically by this sutta, but in many other suttas, it's the exact opposite. Engaging in this way perpetuates the cycle of dependent origination. Now, that is not a judgment on the music or on the art as being a good or a bad. That is just specifically related to approaching these spiritual tools as tools to help us reach deeper understanding. But if these tools require the chain of dependent origination in order to process them, then we're just reinforcing that habit. We're not breaking that habit. Do you understand? Yeah. And so what the breathing, the anapanasati, satipatthana gives us is now segueing into what you said before, Johnny. It gives us the ability to stop and realize that this thing we're seeing or this thing we're hearing, that's just our cycle going round and round without judging it as good or bad. It's just for more of re-entrenchment of the normal process of paticca-samuppada. Therefore, whenever we're exposed to something like this, we need to be extremely alert and aware that we don't presume that this tool will help us reach higher levels of understanding, but that it's only a perception, contact, feeling, a matter, materiality, whatever process going on. And in that way, what you said earlier, Johnny, it can be applied to our experiences with these various sense perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So if we understand that these things are solely limited to that process and don't believe that this actual sound or this actual incense or this actual ceremony or this actual image will take us anywhere except engaging in our senses, which is stuck in that cycle, we're okay with it. But the minute we believe that that ceremony is going to clear my karma, or that sound is going to clear my head, or that image is going to take me and allow me to become truly more peaceful, we're actually fooling ourselves.